I am big. It's the podcast that got small. Hello and welcome to Ribbon of Memes, episode 130. This is a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other jaded hacks as masterpieces. I am Nick, the down-on-is-luck writer of the film, and I'm joined as ever by Roger.
I used to be somebody. I still am somebody.
And we are back in the 50s, 1950 to be exact, as we discuss another Billy Wilder film. This is Sunset Boulevard, or to be more accurate, Sunset Boulevard, which is the actual title of the film.
Yeah, well, yeah, arguable, but that's the title that appears on screen because that's the road sign.
Yes, I think it is. Well, anyway, doesn't matter. It is another one of them films where Hollywood is kind of looking at itself and saying, aren't we awful?
But you love us anyway.
But you love us anyway.
So like our previous Billy Wilder film, Double Indemnity, it's mostly a flashback.
Yes, it's got one of the most famous opening scenes in history, in that we have opening narration by a corpse. In this case, William Holden floating in the swimming pool on Sunset Boulevard, face down and very dead. Apparently that shot was a total bugger for them to get as well, floating up at his face, because they tried putting the camera in like watertight bagging or anything. It didn't work. They had to use some mirror system where they shone it down into the pool and back out again. But it's very effective. It's a lovely shot. We join Joe, who is a very down on his luck writer in a very down and in a very Hollywood way. We found out where he's ended up. Does this spoil a film for you, knowing where the film is going to end up right at the start? We've talked about this before a little bit.
Well, I mean, I do prefer that sense of dramatic tension, but it does at least mean that, well, I don't have to worry about what's going to happen. What I care about is how he's going to get there. It's a little like reading a mystery for a second time. You spot all the clues that lead up to this person murdered that person.
Yes, I agree. I don't mind it so long as it is an interesting journey of how you got there. I don't find it ruins a film. But sometimes a film does it just out of trying to be cool and Tarantino-esque, and sometimes that doesn't work well. It does grip you quite well. It helps. William Holden has a nice line in narration. He's exactly... I don't know if this is film... So this is supposed to be like a black comedy, which some people would argue, oh, a comedy that isn't funny. I'm not sure it's a black comedy. I'm not sure if it's a film noir. I know Billy Wilder didn't really care what you categorised it as.
Well, I'd go along with noir because, as in Double Indemnity and as in Sweet Swallow Success, which is not Wilder, it's not the classic noir with the one heroic man who's going to sort everything out. Or at least sort himself out. This is, well, everybody here's at least a bit corrupty.
And there's no really nice... we have a close to a nice sort of innocent character, but it certainly isn't Joe.
Yeah, and even that character is not spotless, as we shall see. Again. So it's running... That edge of, on the one hand, these are all horrible people and you can take pleasure in bad things happening to them. But on the other hand, they have to be sympathetic enough that you can see, well, you know, okay, I can see how a person could get there without being entirely horrible. Yeah, yes, by doing a thing here that seemed sensible at the time, a thing there that seemed like the only thing to do, and then there he is.
It sets Joe up as it feels to me like a classic noir character, or maybe it's just a classic Billy Wilder character. He's just this side of, even if he's pretty despicable in a lot of ways, he's likable, which is where we came unstuck with Uncut Gems which we just didn't like the central character, and felt like, unlike Joe, I'll go back to Uncut Gems again. It really felt like a lot of Uncut Gems was his character's own personal fault. Whereas in both The Sweet Smell of Success and here, it is partly a response to them. As we said in Sweet Smell of Success, part of the problem with these characters is they're like, well, this is the world, this is the way it is, honey, you've got to be like that. And being unaware that they're making the world like that by behaving like that. But still, it's a reaction to how the world has treated them.
Well,
we get with Joe.
On the one hand, we've got Joe. He's being an unsuccessful screenwriter. He goes up to try to sell a script, and all his stuff is rejected. On the other hand, even towards the end, he can go back and work for that Middle American newspaper.
Yes, that's true.
He is staying in Hollywood because he sees a chance to do something with it, rather than because it's his only option.
But again, a little like Sweet Smell of Success, you kind of get the impression he's never going to be happy where he ends up. So, you know, he's always going to be reaching for the other thing. I also like the fact that although he's an unsuccessful writer, he's not a terrible one. You know, he clearly has some talents here.
I think the strong suggestion we're getting is that he's got too much into the give the people what they want, and so he's giving them the exact same thing that they've already got six of.
Yes. And whereas he has, again, it's implied and even shown that he actually has the talent to do that. And also he's open enough to take criticism and come on to that, I guess. But he's a good character. He opens in classic fashion of the bailiffs or equivalent turning up at his door trying to repossess his car.
Yeah, it's just the car finance company's repossession guys.
Yes, which he then fobs off with a story and then drives off, desperate to try and make any money at all, fails miserably, and in order to avoid the car finance guys, turns up a fateful drive on Sunset Boulevard, which is the house of Norma Desmond, faded movie star, played by... This is not entirely fair, but played by faded movie star Gloria Swanson. They tried a lot of other faded movie stars before they got to one that actually wanted to do the film.
Yeah, I think it's a part that requires a certain... given that you want somebody who has been there...
Yes.
It's a part that requires a certain amount of humour about oneself and introspection to be able to do it well, and she does.
She does, and maybe that's in short supply in other Hollywood stars. They tried Mae West, but she was still doing quite well as a sex symbol, even into her 50s, which is nice.
Yeah, she tried to do it in the 80s, and I think she was 80s, and it didn't work terribly well. That was the one with Timothy Dalton.
I do recall. It has some interesting comments here that, you know, she is at like a fading movie. So she's 50, I think, or in 50.
That's the thing. I mean, Swanson herself is about 50 when this is being filmed, and there's a line towards the end where Joe is saying, you know, you can be a woman of 50, but what you're trying to be is the woman of 20.
Yes, exactly. I felt that was not entirely fair because it's not, he's basically saying grow old gracefully. Whereas, you know, Hollywood just doesn't allow that. So I think it's not
especially
entirely fair of him. Especially for women.
To be crude for a moment, she's still, even, except when she's acting completely deranged, she still looks gorgeous.
She did. So. That was part of the problem. They wanted to, age her up. Billy Wilder wanted to age her up to look her actual age because she doesn't really look 50. Instead, what they did was kind of youth down William Holden because she argued successfully to Billy Wilder, well, this is a character that's obsessed with her appearance. She spent a lot of time, you know, beautifying herself and she would look good for her age. And she does. She looks really good.
And this is a possible thing. And there's all this... I don't know, possibly I'm oversensitive to it, but there's a lot of, you know, the old rotting house, the old rotting woman.
Yes.
I don't think it goes completely down that cliche, but it's something to watch for at the very least.
Yes, it doesn't feel entirely original at first, but I pretty quickly it gets into some intro, like the bizarre ceremony. Like when he turns up, we have, the wonderful, I mean, he is great in this film as well, Eric von Stroheim as, is it Max?
Yeah.
The butler.
Who didn't want to do it at all, but he needed the money.
So he was, again, a faded director. or a director.
Actor and director.
Yeah. Actor and director, and a very successful one in a previous life. And he's mistaken for the man who's come to bury their pet chimp. And just this bizarre, I loved that scene where he's ended up basically imprisoned there. He hasn't quite worked out that he's imprisoned at this point, but he's looking out over the yard and watching this bizarre burial of this chimp with this butler and this old movie star. I loved that, just the sort of him just being utterly perplexed by it. But it's a lovely little scene.
And Eric von Stroheim is another of these. I could watch him paging through the phone book.
Yes, so. I'm not sure how much he enjoyed doing it, but he's great. I mean, all these actors, William Holden, I know more as an older actor. Funnily enough,
we've seen him before in Revenant of Memes for Network, of course.
Oh yes, but he kind of ended up as a bitter older. I mean, the last I heard of William Holden, he is the actor who, what's that? Somebody's Diner. Can't remember, but it was a song in the 90s. And she talks about reading a paper about an actor who died while he was drinking. It was no one I had heard of. That's William Holden. So that's how he ended up. I think he was drunk and fell over and hit his head, and that was the end of him. But he ended up as a sort of faded movie star. I guess, don't we all, in the end? But it becomes clear...
Some of us don't get to be movie star first.
Well, that's true. We don't all get the height, so the lows don't seem so bad after that. This mansion is hideous, though. I'd say it's really nicely kind of pseudo-gothic, really gaudy, or at least it was gaudy once. But it turns out that Norma Desmond has been working on a screenplay, and once she finds out that Joe's a writer, and also she, I think, is quite clearly, quite quickly attracted to him.
At this point, I don't think she's attracted to him. It's just, here is somebody who is not outside the circle of about five people who are the only people she sees.
Yes, including Buster Keaton, as Buster Keaton, and other movie stars. It's really nice that we get these little Anna Nielsen. And we had H.B. Warner, who we last saw as Old Man Gower in It's a Wonderful Life, turning up playing, was it Whist they're playing? Bridge? Something like that. But she sinks a talent into him and basically makes him an offer he can't refuse because he hasn't got much going for him at the minute. So she offers him food and board, offers him a lot of pay. It's pretty clear ultimately she kind of controls him with this because he doesn't really see a lot of the money. He just gets bought more expensive suits and toys and jewellery.
He didn't set out to be her kept man, but that is clearly how she sees the relationship.
Now, this is what I like about films of this era. They're all still bound by the motion picture code. And yeah. So it can't explicitly say, you know, that they have a sexual relationship, that he is basically her, gigolo kind of, but it's, if it's not implied, it's kind of clear that Joe is not a man whose morals would prevent him from stooping to that level if it would save him. Well, he'd be disgusted with
particularly
himself.
Particularly when she cuts her wrists at him.
Yes, yeah, she's...
I may have said this before, but as a friend of mine charmingly put it some years ago, a basic principle to live by, don't stick it in the crazy.
That's a good rule to live by, definitely. Well, so Joe gets increasingly ensnared into this bizarre little world.
Yeah, he was a tough, cynical guy, and he just is not equipped for this level of tough cynicism, which I rather like.
It soon becomes clear to him that he's basically a prisoner. And to his horror, it also becomes clear that the butler, Max, is... not really letting on quite how faded she is, and he's writing her fan mail every night, so she's got it to read in the morning. It's a cool little prison he finds himself in, and it's beautifully done and beautifully acted by all of them. This kind of increasing madness and Joe's kind of self-loathing, as well as the fact that he's a prisoner partially of himself as well, because he knows he could go if he wanted to, but it'd be really hard because he'd have no money.
Later on, he is planning to do that. He's just going to say, okay, you know, I will go back to Kansas or wherever it was, tell the finance company where the car is.
Yeah.
I just got to do this one last thing.
Just this one last thing before I retire. Well, he encounters on the set of, is it Paramount? I can't remember what. Because Norma Desmond decides to deliver the script to Cecil B. DeMille personally, who's got, he comes across as quite a benign character here. I gather that's not entirely.
Well, I think the relevant thing here is that she's been getting calls from one of his flunkies, in effect.
Yes, they've been urgently trying to get through to her, and she thinks they are desperate to have her back on the screen, that he's read a script.
She doesn't talk to mere underlings.
Yes, exactly. She's going to go and talk to Cecil B. DeMille. What they're actually desperate for is a beautiful antique car, and who wouldn't be? What a lovely car that is.
Isotto Fraschini, Tipo 8A, 1929 model.
I had a feeling there'd be a Rogers car corner along the way.
I don't know the engine capacity on that, but they went up to a 7.4 litre straight 8, so.
Yeah, but they needed it because they weighed about 3 tonnes.
Yeah.
Lovely, though. And it turns out
three-speed gearbox, that's posh.
Three-speed, goodness me. I don't think it gets a lot of work out in third gear by the looks of it here. But Cecil B. DeMille, being the benign and friendly character he is, doesn't have the heart to actually tell her that he doesn't want her. So he kind of leads her on and says he'll call her.
That's the thing. This is the classic Hollywood glad-handing, which you would think she would be familiar with. Everybody would be familiar with who's been in Hollywood more than 5 minutes. Yeah, we love you, we love you. Meet my friends, everybody cheer for her. We're not actually going to sign anything.
Yeah, we'll call you. But I think she wants it so badly that she just goes for it. I mean, it is the thing that pushes her from borderline deranged to full-blown mental collapse. Because she then goes on to this insane beauty regime. It's also at this point become clear to Joe's horror that she has fallen in love with him. It's very clear he does not reciprocate those feelings, but rather than, you know, doing the decent thing and saying, like, well, maybe it's best if I just go or anything like that, no, he just carries on.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, he has an argument he can make to himself, which is she's tried to kill herself once already, she might do it again.
Yes, but you know that's not really... not really what's troubling
him. But also, he may not have any money, but he's getting stuff.
He is. And he's not completely bereft of emotion, and he's not bereft of
possibly he feels sorry for her more than anything else, but...
Yes. Yeah, he's not a complete monster, but he is. He is one of those men, of which there are many, of which many of us may have been in our time and may still be. One of those men that would just kind of pick the easier path and worry about the consequences later. But, you know, while it's good, it's pretty good. Let's keep up with this. We have the revelation late in the film. I've seen this film before. I completely forgot that it turns out that Max was the one who discovered her, was her first director, and was her first husband. And that just makes this whole living situation just... I don't know why that didn't stick with me, because this time it just puts such a different perspective on that weird relationship that it's even weirder than you imagined at first.
To be fair, there is no suggestion in the film that the divorce didn't stick. I mean, yes, clearly he is still obsessed with her, but...
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But it just, like, now she's having him as a butler and he's kind of happy because he's close to her, he clearly still doesn't want to hurt her feelings and love her. I mean, he's great in this, from this kind of taciturn butler to he actually turns out to be one of the gentler, kinder souls of the film.
He's been pulled into the corrupting influence, but he is basically keeping Norma happy.
Yes.
And to some extent, I suspect keeping her isolated. I mean, he's doing the intimidating butler, you can't come in thing.
Yes, I agree that there's some control. He's being controlled by her, but he's doing his own. He's doing his own controlling back.
Though that could be considered in terms of harm reduction as well.
I feel like he thinks the things he's doing are for her own good, but they've got into this mutually detrimental death spiral, regardless, and which is where Joe enters. But it, you know, he will do anything for it, including letting her have a, you know, a kept young man on the property, because if that's what keeps her happy and keeps her well and doesn't let her go down that route of killing herself again, then that's the thing we must do.
So the other plot line, which we haven't mentioned yet, is back at the beginning when Joe was at the studio, he was talking to a script reader who was very scathing about his script. Not, to be fair, not knowing that he was the author. But they meet up again, and she is basically saying, well, yeah, your stuff is rubbish the way I said, but here in this form, we've got something that could be an actually useful idea, and I would like to develop that, but I can't do it on my own. I need you actually to work with me.
Yes.
And she makes a convincing case for this.
Yeah. She does. I mean, she's kind of, it's, she clearly believes in his skills as a writer, and as you say, she just feels like he sold out a bit and he could do better. I did think it was a bit, you know, she's clearly got a strong narrative sense and a good writer. I felt it was a little sad that she was like, oh, but I can't do it without you. Which makes her a bit of a weaker character, but she's not really there to be a strong character. She's there to be the weak, innocent doe that gets...
Well, up to a point, because where this really comes apart is that she is engaged to one of Joe's friends.
The nicest guy you could ever meet, of course.
And this is where I say even she is not spotless, because she and Joe worked... Basically, he's sneaking out at night to work on this script with her.
Yes.
And she is clearly gradually falling in love with him.
Not that great. It's pretty clear there's an element of seduction, I think, to some extent. In her own way, I think she's trying to... she probably had an idea that it might go this way and didn't resist it and continues not to. So I agree. She's not a complete innocent.
Joe being... this is the way he is being the honourable guy. He is not willing to gazump his friend.
Yeah, and in many ways, Joe really does... I mean, he's cruel about the way he goes about it, but he's aware that she loves him, and he kind of... he wants to shatter that, and so he basically just exposes the truth of who he is to her in a pretty tough love. But I think he does it out of love, in that, like, look, you really don't want to get involved with me. This is the train wreck that I am.
I think he's trying to make it look worse than it is, to be as brutal as possible and make sure she will just break it off with him.
Yes, exactly. But that also leads to him being pretty brutal to Norma at the same time and telling her some home truths.
I think those are effectively two different things. I mean, he's telling her, I am satisfied being a kept man here.
Yes.
Go away.
Which is not true. We know it's not true.
But he then goes to pack to go back to, I think, Ohio? Anyway.
I can't remember now. You've said, I've got Ohio in my head now. You've said it, but I'm not sure.
And these things aren't direct, but yeah, he has to let Norma down as part of the procedure for getting out. He can't just abandon her, or so he feels. On the other hand, he's pretty brutal there as well. You know, there isn't going to be no comeback. Max is writing your fan letters. They only wanted to rent your car, all the rest of it.
Yeah, grow up. And maybe he feels he's doing a similar sort of tough love thing, but it kind of backfires here because Norma's does not cope with that very well. shoots him to death. And that's where we end the film, except not quite, because we have this incredible scene of her. There, she has got an incredible way of moving Gloria Swanson in this, that it's just, in some ways it's caricature, and I can see why people say, oh, it's a comedy, because it is kind of over the top and ridiculous, but still it's mesmerizing.
Can't see this humor. I mean, she has now completely snapped.
Exactly. I don't find it funny, and I do see it through it, but the way she moved, like a kind of a snake slowly coiling away around the camera as she comes down the stairs and up to this final, again, very famous, "I'm ready for my close-up now, Mr. DeMille." And Max is then, you know, playing the part of the director, all again to spare her feelings. I mean,
but also that's a nice little bit. You know, the news guys clearly aren't quite aware of what's going on. So when Max steps up and makes it clear from body language and what he's saying, all right, I am the director, and they just go along with it because at least somebody's telling him what to do.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a really nice. It's a really memorable scene as she walks towards the camera. What happens then? We don't know. I strongly suspect she'll make a lot of money out of the story and get off the murder. But there we go. Yeah. That's just the cynic community. And that's the whole story. But it's intertwined with a ton of these are Hollywood people talking about people who are strongly affected by this sort of thing. We have Gloria Swanson, who is. She's not playing herself, but, you know, there is a strong resonance there from her career.
Well, she was a star of the silent era who faded a bit later. I mean, she did make the transition to sound.
She did.
Back in 77, The Artist, we talked about this a bit more. She did do some sound parts, but she was of the silent era.
But so. She wasn't kind of bitter about it and nuts about it in the way that Norma Desmond is. But it's all kind of exaggerated truth, isn't it? You know, we have this, it's just one, maybe this is why, again, people say comedy, it's just one nudge away from reality into this kind of weird, bizarre world. And that's why it doesn't feel quite like noir inside. It's definitely shot like a noir film. Mm. And the characters are all noir. It also has an element of kind of dark fantasy in a way, or fairy tale maybe. It's kind of a cautionary fable. Except it's not quite clear.
Don't go and visit the Elf Queen. It's not going to end well.
But it has that feel of melodrama, I suppose, is what I'm trying to reach towards. That it's all slightly heightened, and not entirely realistic, but still mesmerizing.
But that is where Norma at least lives.
Yes.
And basically, everything else spreads out from that.
You're right. I mean, from the moment she enters the film, she kind of bends the film in her direction and out of shape, and that's where it gets a little strange. So it's, although we've compared it to The Sweet Smell of Success, it's very different energy, isn't it, really? Because here it's, there it's all frenetic fighting and I've got to get one over. I've got to win. I've got to be top of the pile. This is all, it's all fast. And, if you don't keep up, then you'll be left behind. Here, this much slower, bizarre kind of gothic, melancholy vibe to it. I do like my melancholy, so of course it resonated with me. This kind of sadness of her stardom fading away, and you know, they clearly did love her. She was respected when she goes back to the studio, but you know, things have moved on. We got younger actresses now. Move out the way. It is. There's an element of it.
But the great thing is, again, everybody clearly knows that, but everybody's happy to see her.
Yeah, they're also awful about it in a very friendly way.
She's saying some crap about being in a new film. Well, ignore that. It's a break in the film. That's loud hander.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a real. It's a pretty vicious look at Hollywood in that sense. In the same way that Sweet Smell was a pretty vicious look at kind of the New York kind of, you know, it's not really a world that lives anymore, at least not in that way, but these critics scene. There is I'm always slightly uncomfortable that when these films come along, it's much, you can see that everyone who's involved in filmmaking, and I think Jack Warner went up to Billy Wilder and said some words to how much he didn't like it, and Billy Wilder told him to fuck off or fuck you or something like that. But there's an element that, aside from the people who would feel directly offended by it, all the people involved in Hollywood are going to be much more excited about this kind of film than maybe the average person, because it's not their workplace. So I'm always uncomfortable about these films being really critically acclaimed and everyone loving it because they're all talking about the world that they live in. But I have to say, here it is gripping and fascinating and worked for me anyway, with that reservation on top.
Yeah, also nominated for 10 Oscars, won 3 of them. I think maybe 11. Anyway.
Done all right, didn't it?
Yeah. I think this is something that, as we've talked about, I think it was with Birdman, the film about actors, about the filmy life.
Yeah.
Often gets a few points higher in the Oscar voting than one would otherwise expect, simply because it's, oh, they're talking about us.
Yes, I guess that's what I'm trying to touch on, and it always makes me a bit warier of it.
Hmm.
And I feel in Birdman it did sort of artificially elevate it, certainly beyond my intro. We didn't hate Birdman, but in fact, we liked lots of it. But here I genuinely think it's got a lot going for it, not least Gloria Swanson, this mesmerising central performance, not least Eric von Stroheim. It's hard to imagine anyone else in those roles. I probably could imagine other people in William Holden's role. He's great in it, but he's not sort of the standout character.
He needs to be a slightly rumpled, basically credible guy.
Yes.
So.
And he does exactly what he has to, and he's really good at it, but he's not sort of standout in the way that I feel those two are. It's hard to imagine other people doing those jobs quite so well. Particularly when you know their backstories. I mean,
Fred McMurray, our star in Dublin Indemnity, could have done basically the same role without too much trouble, and vice versa.
Yeah, I agree. I hate to say they're just like standard white guy, but they kind of are. They're very, very good at what they do, and I'm very happy. I wouldn't, want to change them. But as you say, that you could imagine him being slightly interchangeable here. And similarly with Nancy, who was played by Betty Schaefer, who's played by Nancy Olsen. Again, could have been
a very early role for her. I think her first film part was in 1948. Both she and Gloria Swanson appeared in another film 25 years later.
Oh, really?
Which is sort of Ribbon of Memes adjacent, as in I watched it for this, but I don't think we ever talked about it on air. Airport 75.
Oh, really? Okay, yes.
Where Swanson is the very old, confused film star telling scandalous stories. And Olsen, I can't remember, she's one of the fairly minor roles in it.
Wow, that's interesting.
I don't think they ever meet in that, but then they never meet in this either. So.
They talk on the phone, don't they? I don't think she actually meets in person. Okay. I mean, it's got a lot to say about an industry that I do not I'm not personally involved in, but it's fascinating to see them all.
All we know is what they tell us and what comes out in court.
I'm not sure quite what the, as I say, it's got a feel of a dark fable, but I'm not sure quite what the message is, as you say, other than, isn't it sad when things fade and people get forgotten?
But also, it's all very well for somebody to be living in a fantasy world, but if you get pulled in, it's going to break you.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. I almost don't care though, because I just think for me, I think it's a great film. Just as a watching experience.
Mm.
From beginning to end, I'm kind of gripped with it. You could argue maybe it's a bit slow. I think the first time I watched it, I felt, oh, this, I watched it, I'd watched Double Indemnity. I liked it so much. I tracked down more Billy Wilder films.
Yeah.
And I remember being a bit underwhelmed by this one for some reason, probably because I've been told it's the best one. And you know, if you're going
to, it was one of the first batch to be culturally or historically significant at the American Film Institute.
Right.
It comes high in polls. It's not the sort of noir I usually think of as noir, but yeah, I won't argue that it isn't noir, because I mean, I have to call it that.
I think that we've had a whole episode debating noir, and it almost doesn't matter. I was much more mesmerised by it this time, I have to say. Probably because I was going in with slightly lower expectations, but I think it's less... It's less twisty and it's less kind of cool and satisfying in a way as Double Indemnity, but it's just, it has a quality, particularly Gloria Swanson, and that pairing of Max and Norma Desmond.
Mm.
There's something about them that is absolutely mesmerizing. And then just watching this poor schmuck just get ground in between them in their own way. I found it absolutely fascinating this time, and I'm not sure I liked it more than Double Indemnity, but I certainly liked it a lot this time.
Hmm. And I will certainly no question on this one, masterpiece.
Yeah, I think so. This is kind of what, these are the sorts of films that made me think, oh, I really should watch more films. If there's things like this hiding around that I haven't watched before.
I mean, we're watching Crowd Pleasers as well. I think we've perhaps drifted a bit from our initial mission of great films, but yeah, let's certainly do more of this sort, which do turn out to be great. In spite of everybody saying they're great.
Yes. Well, we've watched a lot of films that everyone said they were great and we didn't think so. But this one, we agree. It is a really great film, and not much more to say, but it's been analysed way more than I guess we can do here. We'll come up with more insightful things here. And again, by people in the industry who knew some of the people involved. But just as a story, it's really good.
Mm.
Good job, Billy Wilder. Keep it up.